Today is Monday, April 30th, 2007. My name is Sandy Fehler, and I am an interviewer with the University of Wisconsin-Madison Archives Department Oral History Project. Today, I am interviewing Dr. Katrina Forrest, Associate Professor in the Department of Bacteriology in the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences. In addition, Dr. Forrest is affiliated with the Graduate School's Biomolecular Chemistry Program. Good morning.
Good morning.
We're going to start this interview by asking you to talk about your early life, where and when you were born, where you went to elementary school, high school. Mm-hmm. Were there any people in your family or friends that influenced you in your career path?
Okay. I was born in 1966 in Honolulu. Actually, my dad was in the Navy, and he was stationed at Pearl Harbor, so I was born there. But within a couple of months, we moved to Philadelphia, where my father was a graduate student at Penn. And we lived on Gorgas Lane for about 5 years, during which time my sister was born, and my dad finished his degree. And then we moved to Maryland, close to the USDA Agricultural Research Station, which is in Beltsville. I went to elementary school there from kindergarten through halfway through sixth grade. And actually then we moved to Madison. So my father took a job at Dairy Equipment Company as an engineer, and my sister and mom and I moved here then. We spent a short little time on the east side, sort of while we were looking for a house and a place to settle for the long term. And then my parents bought a house in the town of Dunn, right near Goodland Park, which is where I lived from 7th grade through 12th grade, except for my junior year, which I spent abroad in Germany. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's the early... So I went to school in Oregon. I think I just said that. and my junior year abroad was a huge influence on me. So I spent, July till July in Germany, living with two different families. And I think maybe more than any one person, that was a very influential year for me, because, you know, it sort of set me up to be independent and to know that I could just decide to do something and go handle it.
Did your mother have a career outside?
Yeah, she had a degree in rural sociology from Cornell, but she never really pursued that as a career. When we were in Philadelphia, she worked as a doctor's assistant, and when we were in Maryland, she stayed home for several years, and then actually shortly before we moved to Wisconsin got a job that I think she was enjoying a lot. I think it was sort of hard for her to move. And then here she worked as a temporary, what's it called, you know, sort of like a Kelly Service temporary agency employee for a while. And one of those jobs ended up being a permanent job for her, so she worked at the Strauss Printing Company for several years. But she actually got cancer, breast cancer, when she was 41, and died when I was in college.
Were there any teachers that influenced you in your higher education?
So far we've only gotten to high school. I would say one of the things...
Before you went to college.
Before I went to college. You know, one thing that I think has always, I feel pretty strongly was a big influence on my life was that my sister and I were both girls. And I think that being the oldest, you know, the sort of ersatz, oldest son in my family, meant that there were no boys competing with me to be the science and engineer types in my family. Mm-hmm. So I actually think that was a pretty big influence, and it's hard to know whether I would have done what I did if I had had a brother. But I think my dad always, and my mom, both of my parents, encouraged us, and we were constantly solving little problems on car trips and asking for help with our homework and getting, you know, first principles rather than just help with getting the answer. So we were always kind of pushed like that.
So it was a given that you were going on to college?
It was a given, I would say. Yep. And I don't think my parents ever said, you must go to college. I think it was just understood. There's been a fantastic tradition in my family, which my husband and I are trying to keep up now, which is that it was assumed that my parents would pay for me to go to college in the same way that my dad's parents had paid for him to go to college, and that we would have to pay for someone to go to college sooner or later, but it would be our children. So that was another, I think, a very obvious support system that my parents had set up. You know, there wasn't ever any question that we would figure out some way to pay for it. In terms of teachers who really influenced me, no, not really, actually. I can't say that there were.
How did you make your decision on where to go to college?
It was tough, actually. I remember that spring wishing that my parents would be a little bit more hands-on and kind of give me a little more guidance. They were very careful not to step on my toes and to let me make that decision. So I went around and visited several places, and in the end it came down to a choice between MIT and Georgetown. In addition to being sure I was interested in science, my other big love is foreign languages. And so actually I had applied to the School of Languages and Linguistics at Georgetown. And I went to visit both of those places for a day. And when I was at Georgetown, I went to visit, I think, a first-year physics class. And when I was at MIT, I went to visit a German literature class. Hmm. And I decided that, you know, there wasn't going to be any question that the science education at MIT would be great, and vice versa for the language classes at the School of Languages and Linguistics at Georgetown. But I actually thought the German literature class that I went to visit at MIT was superb, and somehow I felt like I could keep doing both things better there, and that's how I made the decision. So I not only would have gone to a different school, you know, I would have had a completely different path through my life if I had made that decision.
Was it a good decision?
Fantastic.
Decision? Talk about your four years there.
Three. In fact, two and
impressive.
A half when it comes right down to it, because partway through I came home and actually went here to the UW for one semester. I was planning to do it because my mom was so sick. It turned out she actually died right before I came home for that semester, but I did it anyway. So let's see. I lived in the dormitory. Unlike here at Madison, many people live in the dorm the whole time. So that was my social circle mostly. MIT was fantastic because it's very competitive, of course, you know, academically, there's no question about that. But I felt like it was very accepting socially. There wasn't really kind of a stratified social system where you had to wear this or say that to fit in, and I thought that was great. You could really focus on the reason you were there.
How did you handle the stress? There's so many stories about the stress of the academic life there.
I don't know. I don't think I'm particularly good at handling stress any better than anyone else. And when people ask me that now, my only answer is that I don't sleep very much, and I guess that was probably true then too. I did sail on the sailing team, and that was a lot of fun. I never really progressed to anything advanced. I was a crew the whole time, but it was just great to be part of that. Yeah, I don't have a good answer. I enjoyed being in Boston, so I actually took advantage of Boston quite a lot, and you know, got standing room only, last minute tickets for the symphony fairly often, and things like that. Mm-hmm. Looking back, I mean, the stress of being a single, unmarried person with nothing else to do but study doesn't sound that stressful now.
Right. I get it. How were the professors there? Were there people there that influenced you on going on to graduate school and pursuing the career that you ended up with?
Yes, certainly. So, I mean, I actually had sort of a classic pathway that I took a class my junior year in the fall that I just fell in love with the subject material and decided to pursue it. So it was biophysical chemistry, which was taught by Paul Schimmel and Greg Petzko. And it's sort of a boring story, you know. I really thought it was a fascinating subject. It was a way to combine a lot of the other classes that I had taken all along. That was something really amazing when I was an undergraduate that I don't know if people always get. I mean, when you get it, it opens your eyes, that I would take three classes, let's say, all at the same time studying the same thing from different points of view. You know, let's say in physics and in math, and maybe in chemistry we would be doing similar things, similar math for different reasons. And when I got to biophysical chemistry, I felt like that was really true, that I was using math and chemistry and biology, and I really liked that integration of all of my knowledge into something that could teach me. I also had considered architecture, actually, and in a way, I always feel like studying the structures of proteins at very high resolution has a bit of architecture involved in it. And we're studying what holds them together and what shape they take on and how their shape influences their function, which is kind of what architecture is all about. So I think maybe, at least I try to convince myself there was a link there to something else that I thought would be interesting.
Were you able to find time to continue the language and literature interest?
Yeah, I took, so my German's pretty good, mostly from high school. And in college I took Japanese, which I've forgotten pretty much entirely at this point. But I, in fact, the semester after I was here at home, I took the intensive Japanese course that's taught here. There are pretty intense summer courses, language courses in the summer. Here.
No. Was there a special reason for that, or was it just another language you wanted to learn?
I wanted to do something a little different. All the other things I have studied have been European languages. And I thought I would do Chinese, actually, which wasn't yet offered at MIT, so it would have meant going to Harvard or getting the bus and going to Wellesley, and maybe that's, you know, they're just, that would have been too much stress for me. So I actually took Japanese starting the first semester it was offered at MIT. Yeah, so it's just a hobby, and I, actually last year we were on sabbatical, and I used that time to take an adult night school Italian class. So I speak tourist of several languages.
Oh, that's good.
Not much more.
That would be fun. So
it's fun. Yeah, yeah, I enjoy it.
Yeah. Now, were there did you have any female professors at MIT?
A few. In my physics discussion class, sort of third or fourth semester, and my junior level molecular biology class. But I don't really think that women in science were a particular influence on me at all, actually. In fact, I can remember sort of, you know, especially as a graduate student, being a little bit turned off by too much focus on women in science, because my strong feeling is that the top priority for promoting women in science is to just be a good one, right? And actually being here, I've learned a lot from colleagues here about why it's important to think maybe more deeply about women in science issues, and I've maybe come around a little bit, but certainly during my undergraduate and graduate years, I wasn't focused on issues of women in science, mm-hmm. because I felt like that was a sidetrack from just doing the science. Mm-hmm. So no, I don't think I could say that any women professors had a huge impact on me.
When did you decide you wanted to be a professor?
I never decided I wanted to be a professor. Honestly.
Well, what happened?
I really just sort of followed the trajectory where you rise to, you know, a certain level, and then it seems like the most obvious next step is to go to graduate school, and then all around you, you know, you're immersed in academia, and the people who are doing pretty well are starting to look for postdocs, so you do that, and so on. And I think I had to be here for a few years before I was really convinced that this was where I wanted to stay. I don't think I necessarily, in fact, the first several years, you know, every year or so, I kind of sat down and reevaluated and said, is this the job I want to have right now? In fact, when I started looking for faculty jobs, I knew that I really didn't want to be a professor then. What I knew was that 10 years in the future, I wanted to have the job that I do have right now. And there were, the way I saw it, not very many pathways to get here without starting out, you know, as an assistant professor and working through this job. I had very young children when I started this job, and it was very hard. So, but I, yeah, so I, it was a trade-off. I mean, I knew, I really did want to be here
now. So 10 years ago, starting this job or thinking about taking this job, I knew that. And I'm glad that I'm here now. But, you know, there could have been alternative pathways which would have been just as rewarding. I don't think it's fair to say this was the only possibility for me.
Well, how did you get here? Where did you go when you left MIT?
I went to Princeton.
And how did you choose
Princeton? And that was partly, that was the beginning of the two-body challenge for me. So I have a husband who's also an academic, and we went to graduate school both at Princeton.
Then you met him at MIT?
No, actually, I met him in high school. So he's 2 years older than I am, and just the last month or so that I was still in high school, and he was a student here, we started going out. Yeah. And then I went away to Boston, and he stayed here, and we sort of kept in touch, and then got married right before I started graduate school.
And so tell me again, how did you get to why Princeton?
Why Princeton? Well, you know, there weren't that many places that we were both interested in. I think it's fair to say in that case, actually, it was really more Carrie than me, deciding his research focus is even smaller than protein crystallography. He's a plasma physicist. So one of the top programs in the country was in Princeton. And I looked at Penn and at Rutgers and at Princeton. It was close by schools.
And was that the right choice for you as far as you?
I don't know. It's turned out okay.
Mm-hmm.
Princeton was not a hotbed of structural biology. There was one protein crystallographer there, mm-hmm. who was my thesis advisor, Clarence Schutt. What it ended up setting up for me, interestingly, is something kind of like where I've ended up now. So I was a protein crystallographer in the molecular biology department. I was certainly the only one in my class, and you know, probably in my program, who was studying protein crystallography in the molecular biology department. And that meant a lot of things. It meant, first of all, that I figured out how to do a lot of things on my own because there weren't a lot of, you know, peers doing the same thing. So that's good in terms of confidence building. It's maybe not so good in terms of really understanding all the nitty-gritty details of some of the things I could have learned. It meant that I got a very broad understanding of a lot of areas of biology, which I would not have gotten if I'd been in a solely structural biology program. And that has served me really well, because here I am, the only protein crystallographer in the bacteriology department, an echo of where I was as a graduate student. And it has the same pros and cons that lab time did. I'm leading a group, but kind of in isolation a little bit in terms of the technology that we use in this department. But at the same time, we speak microbiology and we don't have any trouble interacting with the rest of my colleagues. And I think most of my sort of worldwide colleagues understand that I'm a microbiologist rather than seeing me as, oh, there's that crystallographer who tries to, you know, walk in our world. And so that's been great. But it's hard to be, you know, in isolation sometimes. You can't walk next door and say, have you ever run this program, and what did you do here and there? So it was wonderful. A couple of years after I was here, Jim Keck in the biomolecular chemistry department and George Phillips in the biochemistry department came, and they're very interactive, and that made a huge difference for me. We still don't do as much together as we would if we were all in one department, but that's been a big plus. It would have been hard to keep going without some more colleagues like that.
Well, then what about when you were in grad school? Were you able to find colleagues across the campus that you could work with?
No, I relied a lot on, ultimately, sure. Actually, after I'd been there a few years, we just got really lucky. Bristol-Myers Squibbs, which is very close to the Princeton campus, opened up a structural biology group. And before their space was ready, they actually sort of moved in and shared our equipment. And so that was the first chance I really had to have daily contact with many or several other crystallographers. That was great. And then the most important sort of insertion here is that I did a postdoc in between being a graduate student and being a faculty member, which almost everyone in the biological sciences does. And I did that at Scripps, where I was surrounded, just breathing crystallography all the time for 3 years. And I couldn't have made the leap to being a faculty member if I hadn't done that first. That was the time when I really specialized and learned lot of the nuts and bolts of what I do now.
So what is a crystal, protein crystallographer?
Mm-hmm. Well, we're interested in what proteins look like at very high resolution, where all the atoms are in a certain protein chain, how it folds up, and how its structure drives its function. So a protein crystallographer is someone who purifies proteins and coaxes them to come out of solution as crystals, and then uses X-ray diffraction techniques to figure out where all the electrons are in the protein, so where the atoms are.
Mm-hmm. And why is that important? What is it that you're working on that you can talk about?
Good. I can talk about all this. So originally I started out working on proteins because they were potential targets for antimicrobial therapies. But really, when it comes right down to it, it's because we're interested in the basic molecular mechanisms of how these proteins work. So right now, my lab does a lot on a molecular motor that bacteria use to move across solid surfaces. And by solving the structure, we've learned a lot about how that motor functions, sort of, you know, nano-machine understanding. My lab has also made a pretty big contribution in the last couple of years by solving the structure of a photoreceptor that's in all plants and it turns out in many bacteria that they use to sense the time of the year, the length of the day, things like that. And we showed that protein, so we answered a lot of long-standing questions about how the chromophore fits into the protein. But we also showed that protein is a knot, which is very unusual. There are only a small handful of proteins which, when you pull on the front end and the back end, they don't just turn back into a string. And we think that knotted structure has something to do with the ability of the protein to move in different directions.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine that your field must have changed dramatically since you started.
It's absolutely true.
Talk about that.
Yeah. So several things have had a huge influence on how my field, how it sees itself and how many people go into it. When I started as a protein crystallographer, everyone was still sort of, in an academic sense, related to everyone else. I mean, you could work for one person who had worked for someone else who was one of the founders of the field. And that was kind of interesting. Actually, that reminds me, I was going to go back to, let me just finish a previous question.
Sure.
You asked me what other, how did I learn things in graduate school when there was such a small lab?
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I went yearly to the American Crystallographers Association meeting, which now is not such a big part of my career, but when I was young, was a source of a lot of information for me and a lot of peers. So just to sort of slide that in.
Mm-hmm.
Where was I?
How the field has changed and everybody knew each other.
Right, everybody knew each other. And then as time went on, and several things became easier. The first one was molecular biology, essentially. It became possible to quickly clone a gene and put it in a plasmid, which could be put in a bacterium, which would then overexpress the protein you were interested in. So when I was in graduate school, there were, you know, on left and right, there were meat samples from the butcher and giant stacks of spinach from the grocery store. People were purifying proteins out of their natural sources. And now almost everything we purify has been expressed in a bacterium, in my case. So that's one. The second one is that we went from collecting most of the data in-house, so in our own lab on an in-house rotating anode to generate X-rays, to collecting almost all of our useful data at a synchrotron radiation source, which is much more brilliant. And so that sort of, I was probably one of the first ones to do that during graduate school, I and others. I mean, not to single myself out, but I was there when we started doing that kind of data collection. The third thing is that we learned how to preserve crystals using very cold temperatures. So irradiating protein crystals with X-rays is not a gentle thing. And water in protein crystals leads to free radicals, which damage the proteins in the crystal. So protein crystals don't last very long. And in synchrotron beams, especially current synchrotron beams, they just sort of vaporize. So by preserving them at liquid nitrogen temperatures and collecting data on cryopreserved crystals, we extended the lifetime of crystals and made data collection much better. And then the fourth thing is simply the speed of computations. I mean, it used to be, when I was in graduate school, we'd go collect a lot of data, bring it home on tapes, get home from the synchrotron, you know, load the tapes on and start the jobs that would process these frames and come back in a day or two. And if something had gone wrong, you'd have to start all over and wait another day or two. Now, you know, we certainly process all the data at the synchrotron, and many times we've solved the structure, at least the initial electron density map of the structure, before we ever leave the synchrotron. So we can reprocess the same data over and over and try different tricks and see what's right and get the whole thing done much more quickly. So that's the speed of the computations. But then the other thing is just the programs themselves, the algorithms, and the user friendliness has increased exponentially as more people have entered the field and the data collection has become quicker, and the bottleneck became, you know, the computational programs that were available. Much of that has happened because of the structural genomics efforts that who have as their goal to solve all the structures of, you know, to solve the structures of all the proteins from any one organism, for example. Sort of like the Human Genome Project led to much faster DNA sequencing capabilities. Mm-hmm. We've also seen the benefit from the structural genomics groups. Mm-hmm.
You went from MIT to Princeton to the Squibb Lab.
Scripps.
That's okay. And then you came here?
Yep.
Okay, I'm going to have a question about that. But sure. How did you get here?
Well, we'd been in San Diego for 3 or 4 years. And, you know, it became time to start thinking about what was going to be the next move. And we contemplated trying to stay in San Diego. My husband was actually working out for an academic lab, but for a company, and he got offered sort of a long-term, you know, staff position. Mm-hmm. But the lifestyle in San Diego was great for a few years, but commuting an hour each way to work and, you know, the cost of living and having small children who were commuting with us back and forth was not a great long-term solution. So we were interested in finding jobs in a somewhat more livable city, although we actually considered very seriously Boston and New York City. But I think those would have been more livable than San Diego also, because we would have lived right in the city and made that work. So we thought about staying in San Diego, but even if we had stayed, it would have meant a move, you know, somehow closer to work into even a smaller place. So we applied for jobs. And Madison has a pretty good understanding of how many scientific couples have this two-body challenge. And they were very welcoming mm-hmm. to us, to both of us. Mm-hmm. So that was a big part of coming here, that we both had a job and that we knew we could afford a house that we could walk to work from. So I'd say those are the two main reasons. Many people ask me, or just assume that we're here because I went to high school here, and actually it turns out because my husband is from here. Mm-hmm. But it's not true. I mean, we came here for all the reasons that I said, and of course we knew we liked Madison because we had been here. Mm-hmm. But if the same pair of jobs had opened up in some other wonderful city, I think that we would have been just as interested. So it wasn't because we were, you know, from here that we came back.
Did you both come in as assistant professors?
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to ask you about that too, but when I came into your office, I walked through your lab.
Uh-huh.
And how does this lab, and this is an older building on campus, and there's so many science buildings mm-hmm. being built all mm-hmm. over, how does this lab compare to the other labs that you've worked in through your career?
I believe, and it would be interesting if somebody ever hears this tape and has different information, but I believe that I'm in the oldest functioning lab on campus.
Really?
So for those listening, you know, years from now, this is on the top floor of the old section of the biochemistry building, and it's never been renovated, so, or at least not what we would consider modern renovation. So we still have wooden bench tops, for example, and wooden drawers, and we have very poor ventilation. There aren't any windows in the lab. The flip side is I have the most beautiful office on campus.
You have a beautiful office.
So my office is under the eaves with sort of attic style sloping windows and so on. And this is all temporary. So when I started, we were in Fred Hall, which was knocked down partway through my time here. So we must have moved here in the fall of 2002, in the fall of 2002. So this temporary space has been 5 years, you know, most of my time here. But
do you think you will ever be moving out?
Oh, yeah. So we'll be moving to the new microbiology building, which is nearly done. So we'll move again this fall.
Well, that's exciting.
Yeah, that's very exciting. Yeah. But, you know, when I was first here and people were asking me, you know, about the new building, it was hard for me to put a whole lot of focus on the new building because I knew I still had to move into this building and get tenure and, you know, teach students and get grants. And so for people who had been here for a long time, it was possible to look forward to this new building. For me, this building, this old one that we're in right now, is where I've been the longest.
Will you miss it?
I'll miss this office.
Yeah.
I definitely will. But I don't think any of us are going to miss the lab.
Yeah, right. What's interesting is you have a window that opens, and a lot of these new buildings, none of these windows
open. That's
right.
That's right.
That's unfortunate, because today's a beautiful day to have that window open. Well, when you came to
Madison... Can you pause it for just a second?
Oh, sure.
So there is one very interesting story about this office. Paul Ludden, before he left the campus, happened to be in the building on the same day I was taking a tour, and he brought me into this office and pointed out the window and said that K.P. Link, who's a famous old biochemist in the biochemistry department, used to have this office and used to sit here and shoot squirrels out this window on University Avenue. I thought that was kind of fun. And there are other good stories about this lab. Warfarin was discovered here in this lab. So I sometimes say that before we move out, I'll have to just extract the bench tops and patent whatever's still there.
Absolutely. When you came here as an assistant professor, what had you heard about the reputation, and was it what you expected, your department?
So the bacteriology department has a phenomenal reputation, as does the biochemistry department worldwide, and I knew that, of course. The things that were different than what I expected, the main one was that coming from Princeton and Scripps, I was used to labs where most of the research was done by postdocs. So graduate students, of course, were part of the picture, especially at Princeton, not so much at Scripps. But really, the research engine was kind of driven by postdocs. In my department, there were very, very few, maybe only one or two, you know, when I first got there. So research labs at Madison were very much geared around graduate student research and training. I think that Madison is in trouble right now as far as that goes, because the amount of money that's being required of principal investigators to pay for graduate students in their labs goes up and up as the budget situation gets worse and worse. The university demands more of the money from the PIs directly, and it's more expensive, or about the same. I should be careful because I don't know the exact numbers, but it's really almost a toss-up in terms of funding whether you now can hire a postdoc or a graduate student. And just from a completely practical point of view, having nothing to do with philosophies about teaching, which are important, but just from a practical point of view, graduate students don't really start accomplishing research that can be published for the first several years. So if you just think about it from a budgetary point of view, it doesn't make any sense anymore to hire graduate students. Of course, part of the reason we're here as faculty members is because we would like to train the scientists of the future, this is not just lip service. I mean, many of us feel very deeply about that, and so we continue to take students. But that won't go on forever, because you know, the bottom line, especially now when funding is so hard to come by, is a serious issue. So that's changed since I got here, this inability to sort of pay for students on this research funding that's available. It's getting worse. So I think over time, more labs start to take postdocs and take advantage of them.
This is, I'm sure, a naive question, but what's the solution to that? I mean, you've got the university taking more money, and yet it's harder for you to get money,
yeah,
right?
There are a couple, this kind of political stuff, I guess, but first of all, you know, the U.S. government's funding of science is pretty pathetic. I guess that's fair from my point of view. The other thing is, the state of Wisconsin maybe doesn't support the university to the level that it needs to. So I'm not an expert. I'm not the one to give you the details, but the state funding of the university has become a smaller and smaller and smaller fraction of the total university budget over time, so that really we're practically a private institution with some strings from the state government. And of course there's state government funding, it's not that it's zero, but those two things, so federal funding is harder to get, and the state support of the university has become a smaller and smaller fraction of what's going on.
Where does your funding come from?
From the Keck Foundation, from the NIH, from the NSF.
And all of those are, there's just more competition and less money, or?
Well, the Keck Foundation is a non-renewable young professor award, so that's essentially done this year. The NIH and the NSF are sort of constant competitions. Both of those grants currently are, you know, have renewals under review. So, and my NIH grant wasn't funded last year, but I mean, lots of us are in this boat. So funding is harder and harder to come by.
Talk about the tenure process.
Okay. I mean, I went through the same process as everyone else, where funding and publications are the most important part of it. My department was extremely supportive, which was great. I actually did not have a positive vote in the divisional committee the first time through, but luckily there was still enough time to, you know, before my tenure clock ran out, to go through the divisional committee again. And what changed in between those two times, the biggest criticism, well, there was a standard one, was just not enough publications that were all clearly independent work. And the other one was that the letters that are written for support of a tenure case are supposed to be arm's length in quotes, which means people who have heard of you or read your work professionally but who don't know you very well. And if you do a good job and make yourself well known and go around to meetings and meet all the people in the field, then it's hard to find arm's length letters. And so that was another criticism, was that my letters weren't arm's length enough. So I submitted a few more papers, and my department got some letters from people who I really had never met, and I put those in the file. And my vote was unanimous the second time around. So my case was, you know, it wasn't a slam dunk. It was tricky. My productivity was, a lot of it was collaborative, and I don't think that, you know, it's a bit of a catch-22, because collaboration and interdisciplinary work are such buzzwords now and supposedly so highly valued. But at the same time, tenure means you're a completely independent, you know, principal investigator, and you need to be able to demonstrate that. So you're, you know, one walks a fine line, and if you've done enough work, then having some collaborative work is fine. But I guess it's not too obvious.
It sounds also that you would almost have to be in collaboration with other people. You're the only person that does what you do. And
well, here, in this department.
In this department,
yeah, yeah. Okay. Certainly, I'm certainly not the only one who does what I do,
no.
Not by a long
stretch.
Well,
do you collaborate with people on campus and also colleagues in other institutions?
Yes, that's true.
Okay, I see.
But my lab definitely has some part of it, this major part of our focus is within our lab. So all the work on this motility motor that I talked about,
mm-hmm.
That's all contained within our lab. That's not collaborative.
I see.
Yeah.
Talk about your teaching. Do you enjoy teaching?
Yes, I do.
What do you like about it?
So I've been really lucky, because the class I teach is just what I love to do. I developed a class when I got here, which is basically teaching structural biology to microbiologists. So most microbiologists are never going to solve their own structure, but these days, with 70,000 protein structures in the database, most of them are aware of structural biology and of how much it can help them. So I essentially teach a class on how to read a structure paper. It usually has between 12 and 18 people in it, and we have half or more of the classes in a classroom with computer graphic stations. So all the students are able to really use 3D graphics to look at protein structures. And what I try to do is teach them that just because a protein structure is published or in the database, they still have to treat those results with the same scientific caution that they would treat other results. There are a lot of things that can be different between from one protein structure to another. The resolution is the most obvious one. So really it's about what is it fair to take away from a protein structure and what questions can't be answered by a protein structure of certain resolution or quality. So graduate students in this department are trained very carefully, you know, to be wary of the results and to get reproducible results and what error bars are and, you know, what's overinterpretation, what's fair, what alternative hypotheses are, all those kinds of things. And what I try to teach them is that those same questions apply to structural biology.
And then you you work also with individual graduate students in your field.
Yes.
Talk about that.
So my lab has, until this year, well, my very first year and this year, we've had microbiology students. But otherwise, in 10 years, you know, all my students have been from other degree programs, biomolecular chemistry and biophysics and cell and molecular biology, to name, I think those are the main, those are the three. So those students come in with slightly more quantitative backgrounds than the students in the microbiology program do.
Talk about some of the students that you've had. What have they gone on to do?
Sure. So it's only been this year that my first few students have started to graduate. Johanna Hansen from the biomolecular chemistry program is now a postdoc at the NIH. And she's working in immunology lab. Her thesis was very immunology oriented. She didn't actually solve a structure, but took a structure that I had solved before and adapted it for what we hoped would be vaccine purposes, and then studied it, the immunology of that molecule. Jeremiah Wagner is actually here. So he was jointly advised by myself and Rick Veerster in the genetics department. And he, after graduating, joined my lab as a postdoc to work on a different project. Timothy Cordes, who you were reading the article about in the library on the wall, will finish up this summer. And he's going to go on to do a residency in psychiatry. So he's an MD, PhD. So those are... There's a student who I wouldn't say I'm his advisor at all, but who I've collaborated with closely, who's in the biochemistry department, who will finish this summer, who's going on to a very classic academic postdoc in Texas. A postdoc who worked with me in the past, Kelly Okama, is now in Canada at the University of Northern British Columbia working as a scientist. So, and those are all the ones who've managed to escape so far.
Do you have to teach them how to write?
Oh, yeah. And I'm not sure if I'm successful or not, but yes, yes, the answer is yes.
Mm-hmm. How did you learn? From your professors? Or how did you learn how to write? Or have you always been able to?
Yeah, I can't answer that question without sounding kind of pompous, but I don't think my writing was ever quite as bad as some of the students in nowadays. But it probably was, and I just don't remember. And I honestly can't remember my advisor having to spend as much time with me on papers as I do now with my students. I learned to write, I may not be a very good writer. It's not that I'm particularly good, but I think some of the skills that I learned just in English classes along the way stayed with me. I think I read a lot of papers and partly modeled my scientific writing after the papers that I had read. When I was in graduate school, many of the classes that I took also had a writing component.
That's right. You did that language and literature path also.
Well, yeah, mostly for the fun of being able to talk to people in other languages, not so much for the thrill of writing.
But I'm sure learning grammar and other languages.
That helped an enormous amount. I don't know if it helped all the way to the stage of writing scientific papers, but yes, I think that speaking German my junior year actually clarified my writing in English my senior year. Mm-hmm. because I had been weaned off of some of the terrible habits we have in colloquial English.
Do you enjoy that part of your responsibility, the writing and publishing?
I enjoy, my favorite part of writing is when you get close to the end. And, you know that you've got all the facts in there and you're really working on making it clear and readable. And sometimes, especially, it's interesting. I think that the papers we write, I might be making an overgeneralization. I was going to say the papers we write as collaborations are sometimes muddier because too many people are working on it, but that's actually not right. It just depends. It depends on how clear the story is. Some papers write themselves because the results are so beautiful and so illuminating. You just know what you need to say, and you say it and you write it. And some papers are hard to write because you have 10 different results, they're all kind of related, you know they ought to be published, but the story isn't really that thrilling, frankly. And it is that, for me, the first scientific paper I wrote was a review article. And I think that was actually good because it gave me a chance to focus on the writing less than on my own contribution to the writing. And that's also been something that one of my students has done. And I think that was a good idea, actually, to work through the opportunity to write a review mm-hmm. before writing a first author paper.
Now we're going to switch gears a little bit, and if you would talk about your involvement in faculty governance, any committee work that you've done on campus, other campus activities, what service responsibilities have you enjoyed the most? Mm-hmm. What would you never do again?
Okay. I'll just hit some of the highlights. Like everyone, I'm on, I want to pick a careful number, dozens of thesis committees, and I review papers for many journals and review grants for the NIH and the NSF. On campus, some of the things that I do that I think are actually worthwhile, I'm currently this year the faculty one of the two faculty co-directors for the Women in Science and Engineering Residential College, WISE.
Yeah.
So that's a 2-year commitment with one person rotating off each year. It's a dormitory, right? This year it's physically located in Cole Hall, and we have about 60 freshmen who come in having pre-decided they would like to live together, all women, and have the opportunity to help each other with their science. I think when I was at MIT, living in the dorm, it wasn't a women-only situation, but it was very much the same kind of idea that you're in a living group of people who are going through the same stresses and excitement together, and it's very solidifying, and it's very comforting to have someone else who can't figure out the same physics problem you can't, or who has figured it out and can help you. So that is something that I wasn't expecting to be as rewarding for me personally as it's turned out to be. I accepted it because it seemed like a reasonable assignment and something I should just pitch in and do. But it's been wonderful for me to have an avenue into the undergraduate world which doesn't involve assessment. So I am not evaluating these women for any academic course. And that means I think that the communication is more frank between us, among us.
So my role
is actually pretty academic in that group. I am responsible, I will be next year, and actually my co-director did a lot of it last year, for organizing a weekly seminar series. So we have dinner together and bring in faculty members, for the most part women faculty members from on campus or business people from around the city.
That sounds exciting.
And so next year will be not just science, which was mostly this year, but also we're going to try and bring in affiliated faculty members to talk about similar topics. I think I mentioned this actually before, seeing the same thing from multiple points of view.
Right.
So we might bring in, for example, a patent attorney and a scientist who, invented something, let's just say.
Mm-hmm.
Or a physical therapist and a dance professor and biomechanics professor who talk together about recovering from injuries, for example. And this is a great chance for the students to kind of broaden their horizons a little bit and understand how much Madison has to offer
sometimes even if you don't take advantage of resources, it's kind of eye-opening just to know that they're there, just to understand how world-class your university really is. So that's largely my role, and sort of oversight and generally providing some kind of stamp that looks good from a faculty member's perspective. But really the program is run on a daily basis by a program coordinator who's a staff person and by an intern who's an undergraduate, upper level undergraduate who's been in the program before.
Do you know how the students find out about this program?
When they apply to the housing office. It's all run through the housing office.
Oh,
it's one of the choices for housing.
I see.
Yeah.
That's
so that's been pretty neat. The first couple of years I was here, I was very involved in, along with one of my colleagues, Heidi Goodrich Blair, we wrote a cluster hire proposal. So a lot of the faculty members that are hired or have been hired over the last half a decade or so have been hired through interdisciplinary cluster hires. Heidi and I wrote a symbiosis cluster hire, which was funded, and then we did the search committee and hired several people, and it's been wildly successful as far as I'm concerned.
Are
so
they still doing cluster hiring? Do you know?
I don't think there's been a new round for a while, actually.
Mm-hmm.
However, there's active pursuit of trying to keep the cluster hires going and organized and funded. And yeah, in fact, today one of the things I had to finish is turning in some stuff about the cluster hire. Yeah. So that was a really interesting service because it was, I think, maybe only our second year here that Heidi and I proposed this to the department at a faculty meeting. The idea was to come with some brainstorming ideas for what cluster hires we could propose. And everyone said, that sounds great. And then they said, why don't you write it? So, well, that sounds good, except that it turned out we wrote the pre-proposal and it was accepted, which meant we needed to write the full proposal. It turned out really that we invested an enormous sum of time into it. And I think it was, you know, questionable whether that's what we should have been doing with our time that early on in our assistant professorhood. I think it was very successful. I'm very glad Madison has these people now. I'm proud to have been one of the people who's responsible for the fact that they're here, Cameron Curry, Jean-Michel Annet, Ned Ruby, Margaret McFaulnay. But it was a tricky political thing because after our department realized how much time we were putting into this, then they started to say, well, maybe you should give this up. But neither Heidi nor I was about to give up on something that we had committed to. So that was an interesting lesson.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, maybe if they had known we would be successful, they might not have suggested we get involved. Another thing that I'm involved in right now is I'm on the steering committee for the Life Sciences Collaborative Access Team Beamline at Argonne. Madison invested $500,000 several years ago to help build this facility, which is a protein crystallography data collection site. But we're having a lot of trouble generating the yearly maintenance funds that are required from our part of the commitment. And that's kind of another funding frustration because I don't think any other university worth its salt at this caliber would be having this problem. So that's another thing that I've been involved in. And then I'm on the steering committees of a couple of different training grants and graduate training programs, biotechnology and biophysics.
And didn't you tell me you're on the information technology?
And I'm on the information technology committee, yeah.
In your spare time.
Yeah.
Have you done, are you, in, oh yeah, you said you've got departmental committees and campus-wide committees.
Yeah, I mean, it's not an infinitely long list. In the department, I'm on the curriculum committee. Campus-wide, the information technology committee and WISE are my two main commitments. WISE is really the biggest time commitment right now.
Who's the core?
Barb Ingham in food science.
Mm-hmm. What about on the national or international level? Are you involved in professional organizations? And what's the extent of your involvement? And is that important to your career?
Mm-hmm.
And if it is, how?
Mm-hmm. So I'm a member of the American Crystallography Association and the American Society for Microbiologists. And
And I would say that right now, neither one of those is particularly critical to my career. However, as I mentioned already, the ACA was very important for me as a younger scientist. And I try to encourage my students, because I know how important it was to me, to go to that meeting. So Jeremiah Wagner actually won the Pauling Prize at the ACA meeting a couple of years ago, which I had won when I was a graduate student. So
what is that?
Fun. Oh, it's the prize for the best student poster at the yearly meeting.
Mm-hmm.
But so no, I don't think right now they are particularly important, and I don't play any service role in any national organizations.
Meetings,
I go to the ACA meeting about every other year,
mm-hmm.
and I go to the ASM meeting less frequently. I do go to, I regularly go to smaller meetings where some of those same people would be. I think those huge meetings, they mostly just serve the purpose of getting you in the same city as a bunch of other people for a short time.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally don't really get all that much out of them.
Would you talk about, you just talked about one award that you received. Would you talk about other honors and awards that you've received in your career?
Let's see. So as a graduate student, I had a fellowship from the Office of Naval Research, which did make a difference in my career at that time because it meant that I could choose any lab I wanted to work in. It didn't matter if they had funding or not. And it made me It meant I was a little more free to pursue kind of wacky ideas, even as a graduate student, because I knew no one was paying me. I was responsible for my own salary at the time. And I won the Pauling Prize then. During my postdoc, I had an NIH postdoctoral fellowship. And then since coming here, I got the Keck Foundation Young Investigator Award, which was 5 years and $1 million of fairly free money. So that was a very big deal, and I think that sort of showed up. You know, people noticed that kind of award. I've gotten an on-campus research award, the Pound Research Award, and that's most of it, actually. Yeah, it's not a super long list, but
quite impressive. I'll bring you back to campus,
mm-hmm.
and before we start, before I ask you about your life after work. Would you talk about the culture for women on campus, the climate for women?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that it helps or hinders people, women, to advance on campus?
You mean being a woman?
Yeah, being a woman.
I think that for the most part, Madison is doing okay. I think that there are mentoring issues for women that are probably problems everywhere. I think it's harder for women to speak up and admit weaknesses, maybe because we're worried about how it would be interpreted. So I think a lot of us muddle through trying to figure things out, where our male colleagues might just say, I don't know what I'm supposed to do, or I don't understand this, and we'll just get help sooner. I think for the most part, no one intentionally discriminates against women. So I think when it happens, it's subconscious. I don't think people on this campus wake up in the morning and say, well, I'm not going to think about advancing her, she's a woman. I don't think it's like that. I had a terrible, still I think one of the biggest problems I've had in my career, authorship battle with a senior male colleague that I honestly don't think would have happened if I had been a male. And that's pretty much the only really tangible sort of discrimination that I've had. And it's actually harming my career now, because it was a very important paper that I'm not the senior author on, that I should have been the senior author on. And I think it causes review committees for awards, for example, you know, to say, oh, well, she's not the main player in that one.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the biggest, it remains, you know, even though the paper has been published for a couple of years, it remains a big problem for me, and I think it probably always will, because it was a very important paper. I have noticed that young faculty in our department, everyone has noticed this, it's not that I have noticed it, get asked to do maybe more than they should, but I don't think it's
because they're women. I think it's just that over the last few years, a lot of the young faculty members have been women.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's been really good for me to have my eyes open to some of these unintentional biases and things. So when I was on the search committee for the Symbiosis cluster hire, there are rules about how searches must include, you know, at least one woman in the final pool that get interviewed and things like that. And I think those are really important. And like I said before, I wouldn't have worried about this so much when I was a graduate student or a postdoc, just kind of pummeling through my own research.
Mm-hmm.
But what's clear, and I haven't, you know, I'm not the one who's discovered any of this wisely on campus, and Joe Handelsman and Molly Carnes have done a lot of pointing this out to me, just not to me in particular, but pointing it out, that women and men subconsciously or unconsciously, you know, looking at written applications, discriminate against the ones with women's names on them without really realizing it, or write recommendation letters using different kinds of vocabulary when they're writing for women and men. Those are the kinds of things I wasn't aware of before the last few years. So that's been really helpful for me, even just in sort of meta-analyzing my own assessment of situations.
Mm-hmm. Now, life after work. Would you talk about your family? And
mm-hmm.
we know a little bit about it from
mm-hmm.
what you said before. How do you balance work and family? How do you stay energetic and healthy? And what do you do for fun and relaxation when you're not working?
Mm-hmm. So I have two children who are now 11 and 13, but when I interviewed for this job, they were two and newborn. So the first 5 years here were very, very tiring. and it sounds terrible, but the main way I have balanced family and work is by not sleeping very much. So that's not good for my health. It's actually, I would say, you know, these 10 years haven't been as healthy as they could have been at all. My kids and my husband, you know, I don't know if that's my after work job. I wouldn't call it that. I don't think people with children consider them their after work activity. That's a pretty big part of my life. Until my children started elementary school, when the second one reached first grade, there was a sort of a lightening for me, because then I knew that no matter what I chose to do with my time, they would both be in school. And somehow that was sort of a release. I felt much less stress about them then. And it wasn't that I so much felt guilty before. Many people put it as guilt. I just felt sad that I wasn't with them. You know, when I was at work, I would be thinking about them, and when I was with them, I'd be thinking about work, and that was, you know, I mean, everyone has this same problem. But for me, when the second one started first grade, that kind of eased up a lot. And then just in the last couple of years, when they've been old enough that if I don't make it home right exactly when I say I'm going to, it's not a big deal anymore, that also has made things, you know, there's been another level of lightening. So it's, I think I was able to predict 10 years ago that this would be okay at this stage. I think academia makes it possible to have a family and a heavy-duty career because it's very flexible. So this afternoon, for example, my son will be home by 2, and I'll go home from 2 till 4, and then I'll come back for a meeting at 4:30 when my husband goes home. And you know, the number of hours I put in is not really is more important, or not even the number of hours, but the amount of work I get done is what matters more than where I am at any particular moment. So for the first, you know, I stayed up late a lot. These days I do have a little more time, so I'm a runner and I do yoga. Yeah. Let's see, what else did you ask?
Are your children budding scientists?
My son loves math. My daughter this year, I think, had a teacher who was very inspired to her, a science teacher, and for the first time sort of embraced it a bit on her own. I think I had this. I never wanted to do quite what my dad did or my mom because I didn't want to be just like them. So I think my daughter, at least, has kind of pushed science away a little bit because she didn't want to be seen as following in our footsteps. So I think it took until she became a seventh grader and had a really exciting science teacher till she decided, okay, I'm allowed to be interested in this just because I'm interested in it, not because I'm following my parents.
Is your father still living?
Yes, he is.
Here?
Yes, here.
And your sister, what does your sister do?
My sister is an actuary. So she had a really cool career path. She has a math undergraduate degree and a math and computer science master's degree, but she wasn't really quite exactly sure what she wanted to do. She taught a little bit and got married and had kids and kind of wasn't quite sure what to do. And then I think she had just sort of an epiphany, one of those things where you read the, what, you know, how do your interests match with your career choice kind of books, and she decided actuarial science must be the thing for her. Mm-hmm. So kind of late in life, she got a job as an actuary and started working her way up the ladder through the various exams, and yeah, I think she likes it.
Does she live nearby?
She and her husband live in Berkeley now. Her husband is Thai, and they moved to Berkeley when her two children were entering school age, and they decided to come back for the U.S. school system mostly.
We've come to the end of the questions,
okay,
but I don't want to turn the tape off. If there's anything that you'd like to say before we end, if we've missed anything. And
no, you covered a lot of ground.
Well, they were very interesting stories, you know, very interesting life. And
oh, thanks.
We're so fortunate to have you on campus. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. My pleasure.